If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
'15 really is the beginning of a very particular English politics, and I'm daring to use the word England, which has actually survived 800 years.
That was David Starkey on the legacy of Magna Carta.
While a former inmate of a concentration camp may laugh and be merry with others, he aches and bleeds inside because the old wounds will not heal. Even though he has left the spatially limited concentration camp, the terrible atmosphere of the camp still encompasses him.
And that was Dan Stone describing the thoughts of a Holocaust survivor. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Welcome to our fifth podcast of April 2015. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Our first interview this week is with David Starkey, one of Britain's best-known historians and a regular on BBC TV and radio. His latest book is Magna Carta, The True Story Behind the Charter, published to mark the upcoming 800th anniversary of the Charter's sealing by King John in 1215. And David spoke to our reviews editor, Matt Elton.
This is something that happens repeatedly. Why does English government in the 15th century break down? Why do you get a Henry VII? Because of defeat in the French War. Because of the Hundred Years' War. Why does John get his comeuppance? In other words, why does the entire hitherto extraordinarily successful structure of Angevin government collapse? It's because John loses France and then he comes perilously near to losing England with Bouvines. You have the loss of Normandy, Anjou, Maine. Britain is the better half of Poitou, and then he has this period of intense government of England, which is designed to amass a sufficient, from about 1206 onwards, designed to amass a sufficient cash hoard to take on Philip Augustus and reclaim it. And the whole thing goes catastrophically wrong with the absolute defeat of Bouvines in 1214. So it's always military defeat. That again, you know, what goes wrong with the government of Edward II? Collapse against Scotland, Bannockburn. And this is, you know, an absolute recurrent pattern.
Mm. So what did the 1215 Magna Carta set out to do?
The 1215 Magna Carta set out to bridle three things, I think. To bridle a king who was dangerous and unpredictable and made the law his whim. Or made his whim the law. Mm. Secondly, it set out, I think, to make it impossible for any other king to rule in the same way. And those first two things are successful. The thing that is the absolute shift, that is the great change, of course, is something very different. It is that it then set out to create a machinery which absolutely bound any king in iron to those things, and that fails, because that would have created a neo-republican government. Mm. And it's perfectly clear, it's highly controversial from the beginning, hence the denunciation of Magna Carta, its repudiation and vitiation by the papacy, and also the way in which you have the wit of the Royal Conservatives, people like William Marshall and the papal legate Gwala, to reenact, as it were, all the good sense bits of the Charter, but leave out the extreme attempt of bridling the king.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this is the key to understanding Magna Carta, that it begins as a thoroughly extremist programme. The extreme elements are then cut out, and it's adopted by the courtier elite. In other words, it begins, as I said, it begins with the extreme Whigs. Mm. It's then re-edited by the Tories, and it becomes common ground.
Yeah, okay. So it loses much of its radical...
I think it loses all its serious radicalism.
Yeah, okay.
On the other hand, of course, you then get the problem, which I tried to highlight in my television programme, the book tries to do something different. The Magna Carta then suspends the whole question of how it's to be enforced. The 1225 Magna Carta actually sketches out what is the long-term way of dealing with it, which is the Magna Carta is reissued in 1225 in return for a grant of taxation. In other words, it's a deal. It's a deal done between the king and his people, the grant of supply in return for redress of grievance. It's the proto-parliamentary model.
Okay.
That's how, in the fullness of time, it tends to be dealt with. But that will never bridle. It will not bridle a Henry VII. It won't bridle a Henry VIII. It will not bridle a Henry III and Edward II. Mm. Any king who wants to drive a coach and horses through it can. And so perpetually you get a return in the Middle Ages to this model of an aristocratic cabal committee, the 25 in some form or another, be it the Lords Ordainers, be it whoever.
Mm.
It never works. It always goes wrong. It always falls over into faction and all the rest of it until the absolutely decisive moment of the 17th century, which, of course, as everybody knows, is the Glorious Revolution. And with the Glorious Revolution, you get, and again, it's always driven by religion. The only thing that produces a decisive solution to all of this is the question of religion. And I think we've got to put back religion much more centrally into this long story than has been the case before. The reason that things go wrong for the government of Britain in the late 16th, early 17th century is religion. That is it.
Mm, okay.
That is what... It's the royal supremacy and the fact that the religion of the king becomes separate from the religion of his people. If you look at the whole struggle of the Petition of Right, what the Petition of Right is an attempt at doing is a question of how do we settle the enforceability of Magna Carta. Magna Carta has suddenly become a big question again because the king is using the machinery of the church and the church courts, and is using the machinery of the prerogative courts against the liberty of the subject. And suddenly, of course, the king's law, the law of Cook and all the rest of it, which had been the great driving force of royal power in the Middle Ages, is turned against the prerogative, but in the name of this Magna Carta view of kingship.
Yeah.
So that's what the Petition of Right is about. It's an attempt at making Magna Carta a fundamental law, a constitutional law. Now, curiously, that is, of course, a solution that's adopted in America. You decide that the way that you will make, as it were, government follow the rules is by having a written constitution with a legal machinery that will hold them to it. The English go down a completely separate route in the 17th century, and we decide instead that we will bind the king to, as it were, agree to what Parliament decides. In other words, we will have parliamentary sovereignty, not sovereignty of law. So, but all of these things are intrinsic in the Magna Carta debate.
Mm.
It's quite amazing how you can trace from those events in 1215, you can really see the antecedents of all our political development going in one way or another.
To what extent is what we know or think we know about June 1215 incorrect?
I think an awful lot of what we know about June 1215 is in the most extraordinarily detailed and accurately documented. I mean, one of the reasons I got so excited about it is that it's, I think, the first event in English history where you can actually see the whole political process at work. You know its antecedents. There was a clamour for the charter of Henry First. That as things hot up, they decide that's not enough. There is a coup, which again is so much like the Civil War of the 17th century, when the barons get control of London. Mm-hmm. What is it that put Charles I over a barrel? It's when the Parliament gets control of the city.
Yeah.
And it's the same story. And at which point, of course, the whole process cranks up. But you actually have the Articles of the Barons, which is the draft of Magna. We have a draft of this document. You can see, as I trace in that chapter, you can see how in a few days it has to be worked up, how it has to develop. You can envisage the poor clerks of the Chancery, you know, working, yes. Having an essay crisis.
Yes.
They've got five days to sort this out. I mean, obviously, the element that's got completely wrong is that we somehow imagine that Magna Carta established at a stroke this foundation of the rule of law, constitution of England and all the rest of it, rather than it being a document produced in a moment of extreme crisis and haste, which had about a third of it really being designed both as a peace treaty, but also as an extremely extremely lopsided peace treaty, because of course John didn't have a leg to stand on. Mm. He had no party and he'd lost control of his capital. One that is designed really to create a revolutionary regime. We never write enough about the 25. The 25 are a genuine committee of public safety. They are self-selected. They are self-recruiting. They swear an oath. Everybody else has to swear an oath to them. Mm. They have to swear. The king has to swear an oath in advance that he will actually follow what this is.
That's amazing. I know.
And they use this machinery actually to create an alternative government.
Mm.
And I really do think that even a historian as great as Jim Holt didn't bring out this extraordinary radicalism. Mm. So when the Magna Carta settlement breaks down in the middle of Henry III's reign, and you get Simon de Montfort, Earl of Leicester, leading another baronial revolt, even he hesitates to go quite as far until the very end of the process, where it's clear that it is a matter of life and death. As the barons had gone in 1215. So it's this astonishing initial radicalism, which is very quickly abandoned by the accident of John's death, the accident of the succession of a minor, the immense level-headed, middle-ground good sense of somebody like William Marshall. I mean, the best sort of old-fashioned conservatism.
Why did it fail? Who can we pin the blame on for that?
Well, I think the settlement was absurd. It could never have worked. I mean, the settlement of 1215 had to fail. The machinery of the 25 was such that no king could have accepted.
So it was bound to fail.
It was bound to fail. It was also bound to fail because the settlement tries to present itself as a middle ground settlement. It tries to present, which is the role, the desperate role of Stephen Langton in trying to act as a kind of a balance, counterweight between the two sides. But its very nature was that it was designed to bring John to heel. He also had not a political leg to stand on. He'd lost control of London. He had only a tiny party amongst the aristocracy and so on. It could never have been an equitable settlement because it's designed to be a one-sided bridle on the king.
Yeah.
Again, it becomes a long-term settlement once you strike out that element of the charter. Again, you see, one of the things that we made a mistake on, the Magna Carta of 1215 has 62 or 63 clauses. The long-term Magna Carta has 40.
Mm.
A third of it is struck out in 1216. And again, it's so modern and so civil service-y. I mean, obviously, you take out all the stuff to do with the Committee of the 25, but then there are all these other clauses on Jews and debts to Jews, on the composition of whatever the representative body that's going to read escutages and talliages and whatever. And there's this wonderful phrase, these are weighty and difficult. And it better be postponed. You know, it is so Sir Humphrey. Yeah. You know, we'll park all this, and then of course it all gets quietly forgotten.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it in that sense, although these people are all speaking Norman French, there's something terribly English about it all. It's almost as though we begin by inventing English-style politics, in,
yes,
you know, as back as 12. And no matter, I romanticise, but
yes,
there we are.
Yeah. So obviously John then dies and Henry comes to the throne. To what extent is the reissue in 1216 a surprise?
Well, I think it's a brilliant political coup. I think it takes everybody by surprise. And of course, remember, it's not only that Henry, this little boy, comes to the throne. England is actually in the middle of the throes of an invasion. Again, we've always forgotten this, that once it becomes clear that John is going to resist the Charter, once it's clear that he is winning, despite the fact that he doesn't have London, the barons are traitors. They invite in the French, they invite in Prince Louis, and immediately the better half of England falls to Louis. So when little Henry III succeeds, he's at Devizes. John has died at Newark. He's been carted the whole of the way across to Worcester. But the dominion of little Henry III is barely the west of England. In the southeast, the king only the royal government only retains control, and only just of Lincoln and of Dover. Now you've lost, and Windsor, you've lost all the rest of the key castles. And so, but what is very striking is, and I've not understood this, and I go into how Louis presents himself and how the baronial faction present themselves. What is astonishing is you invite Louis in because you want to get rid of John, but Louis does not issue or reissue Magna Carta. It seems completely extraordinary. And I think that raises very sharp questions about how serious magnates like Robert Fitzwalter and Sir de Quincey are about it. It raises even questions about people like Simon Langton, who is, you know, one of the ideologues of this process. But of course, it creates this wonderful political opportunity for the government of Henry III, which is to steal the clothes of the Whigs.
Yes.
You reissue the Charter, but you cut out everything that's difficult and awkward.
Yeah.
Now, remember, it doesn't work instantly. It is that Henry III is only secure on the throne once two things have happened. First of all, and they're both military victories. Again, the whole thing begins with a military defeat. It will only be ended by a military victory. First of all, you get the stunning victory of William Marshall. Sort of, you know, this man's 70. He still sort of leaves his troops.
Amazing.
Down, you know, 70. Nowadays, I'm 70. I couldn't. You know, charges off into battle, and you win the Battle of Lincoln. And then there is the defeat of the invasion force led by Blanche of Castile, who sounds an absolutely amazing woman, Henry II's granddaughter. Can't you tell? Her fleet is defeated off Sandwich, and the French lose control of the sea. Mm. And at that point, of course, collapse of Stout Party, collapse of Louis, withdrawal of the French with a very large indemnity, and the restoration of the House of Anjou.
Yes. To what extent did it actually change people's lives in 1225, 1215? Did it make a difference to the ordinary
person? Oh, yes, I think it makes a very, very quick impact on law. And on the development of law, it's very individual clauses are very quickly pleaded. What is striking is just how many copies are circulated.
So why should we care about Magna Carta?
We care about it because it's there. There's a myth. it's an anniversary, all these banal things. Why should we care about it in substance? Because much of the myth is true. 1215 really is the beginning of a very particular English politics, and I'm daring to use the word England, which has actually survived 800 years. The lineaments of England and the English political system are first sketched out in 1215, or rather, they're first sketched out in that crucial decade-long, we could call it the crisis of the charters, like Conrad Russell's crisis of parliaments, from 1215 to 1225. But everything really begins then. And you can see so much. You can see the whole dialogue of Whig and Tory. The charter begins on the extreme left. It survives only because you have Tories clever enough to realise that they've got to steal the Whigs' clothes. You can see models of particular statesmanship, which again constantly repeat themselves. You can see, of course, this crisis of charters leading directly to the establishment of Parliament. The whole structure of parliamentary government really begins with the reissue of the charter in 1225 in return for a grant of taxation. So it matters and it matters and it matters.
What new impression of Magna Carta would you like readers to leave this book with, and its legacy, I suppose?
I would like them to think about Magna Carta not as some kind of sainted origins of the English Constitution, but a product of crisis, of revolution narrowly averted, and of the thing that we've all become so contemptuous of, which is the political process, which is compromise, which is wheeler-dealing, which is not getting quite everything that you want, which is about recognising that your opponents may have a point. Now, we've become very contemptuous of all of those things. It is very dangerous to be contemptuous of those things because that's the root of a Robespierre or of a Lenin. English history is a very different lesson. It's a lesson of this perpetual compromise, perpetual accommodation.
That was David Starkey. Magna Carta, the true story behind the Charter, has just been published in the UK by Hodder and Stoughton. In the US, it is due to be published in September. And you can read more from Matt's interview with David in the May issue of BBC History magazine, which is currently on sale. Also in this issue, you'll find articles on the English Civil War, the sinking of the Lusitania, and the history of slave ownership. You can get hold of our May edition now, in all good newsagents and digitally.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's now time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
Britain is facing a collapse in society, similar to ancient Rome in 100 BC, because we've lived too peacefully for too long, a scientist has claimed. According to Dr. Jim Penman of the RMIT University in Melbourne, the collapse of civilization is inevitable because Britons no longer have the genetic temperament to advance after decades of peace and comfortable living. Penman told the Sunday Telegraph the huge success of the Victorian era will not be repeated because people in the UK have lost the biological drive for innovation. He compared today's Britain to the decades before the fall of the Roman Republic, where social tensions were rife, the gap between the rich and poor was increasing, and extremism was growing. He predicted that by the end of the century, the UK will no longer have the power or will to protect itself against a serious invading force. In other news, a major excavation is underway at Hougoumont Farm near Waterloo, Belgium, where Napoleon's army was thwarted. An international team, including battlefield archaeologists from the University of Glasgow, is preparing to investigate an area dubbed the Killing Zone. There, in June 1815, thousands of French soldiers attacked the farm, which was held by British forces under the command of the Duke of Wellington. Napoleon's forces were eventually defeated, and there were tens of thousands of casualties. It is thought there is a mass grave of soldiers located there, BBC News reports. The team has so far discovered a scatter of British and French musket balls, believed to be some of the first shots fired in the Battle of Waterloo. Meanwhile, a fundraising appeal to meet the costs of reburying Richard III has reached its £2.5 million target. Leicester Cathedral officials said the money had been raised through grants, local businesses and individual donors, BBC News reports. £1.6 million was spent on the tomb and changes to the cathedral, and the rest went on displays and staff to handle increased visitor numbers. The fundraising appeal was launched in November last year, with a £500,000 donation from the Diocese of Leicester. The Dean, the Very Reverend David Monteith, said, "We are so grateful to the generosity of our many donors that has enabled us to raise every last penny needed to reinter the King with the dignity and honour that we set out to achieve." Richard III's remains were discovered underneath a car park in 2012 and were reinterred at Leicester Cathedral in March this year.
Thanks for that, Emma. Before our next interview, I'm pleased to announce that we will be holding two History Weekend events this autumn. One in Malmesbury, Wiltshire, from the 15th to the 18th of October, and the other one in York, from the 25th to the 27th of September. Full details will be available from Monday the 4th of May at the website historyweekend.com. And BBC History Magazine subscribers will be able to purchase tickets from that website on that date. Tickets will then go on general release from Monday the 11th of May. This year, as you'll no doubt be aware, marks the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War. And alongside that, the anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps. Historian Dan Stone, of Royal Holloway, University of London, has written a new book on the subject that considers not just the liberation, but also the complex aftermath as those who had been freed struggled to adapt to their new lives. I spoke to Dan recently to find out more. For those soldiers who actually liberated these camps, what kind of an experience was it? And did they have any idea of what to expect when they got there?
It varies depending on who you're talking about and when. So the first big camp to be liberated was Majdanek, which was liberated by the Red Army. And there, I think the Soviets had some sense that there were places to be liberated that included concentration camp prisoners, because they'd already liberated, obviously, the Soviet Union itself, and then pushed the Third Reich back westwards, during the process of which they'd liberated many regions and discovered places, for example, Transnistria, the area of Ukraine that had been occupied by Romania, where there were large numbers of Jewish survivors. So it wasn't a complete shock, but nevertheless, the camp itself, I think, as opposed to liberating towns or regions where there were survivors, was something of a shock. And I don't think the Red Army soldiers were expecting to see what they did see there, which were the remains of the gas chambers, corpses, bones and so on in large numbers scattered about. When it comes to a little bit later on, to the camps liberated by the Western Allies, Bergen-Belsen, Dachau, Buchenwald and so on, There's mixed information. On the one hand, there are many reports by GIs and privates who say, we had no idea what a concentration camp was. And when we saw one, it was an incredible shock. And these are terrible to read because you forget often these, we're talking about kids of 19 or 20, and they may have had considerable war experience. But all of them say seeing soldiers killed on the battlefield was nothing compared with seeing huge numbers of civilians who were being killed in mass numbers for no reason that they could fathom. And so for them, it was an enormous shock. On the other hand, and this is something that I think still requires further research, there's a sense in which knowledge had been lost. So before the war, there was quite a lot of information available about the concentration camps in the Third Reich in the international press. And during the war, there were reports about the killing of Jews and the mistreatment of other civilian populations. So why there was such a shock on the discovery of the camps isn't really clear. I think it has to do with the fact that huge numbers of concentration camp inmates were being shunted westwards as the Red Army was approaching. So there was chaos in the whole system. The camps themselves were overcrowded, chaotic. What the soldiers discovered there was somehow out of kilter with what they were expecting to see, if they were expecting anything at all.
Did these soldiers, did they encounter any remaining German guards or SS officers, or had they all fled by the time that the Allies would arrive?
No, they did encounter them. In some places, most of the guards had fled. That includes Majdanek and Auschwitz and a few other places. But in some camps, either some of the SS remained while some fled, but often it was the case that some SS remained, but also many auxiliary helpers. So camp guards who were Ukrainian or Hungarian or from the Baltic states who were SS auxiliary members, they were often still there. So when the British liberated Belsen, for example, the commandant of the camp, Josef Kramer, was still there along with a contingent of SS and quite a large number of Hungarian and other so-called Volksdeutsche, so ethnic Germans from Romania and elsewhere who were still there. And, the response of the soldiers, as you can imagine, was often quite brutal, and they were often rather unsympathetic, as you can imagine, to their attempts to explain what had been going on. One SS man who claimed after being found there that, he apparently broke down in tears and claimed he never really wanted to be a Nazi, and it was really unpleasant being a Nazi. And in the Belsen trial, this argument was, of course, rejected and he was hanged. But there was another, one of his colleagues was a Romanian Volksdeutsche who accepted the fact that what he'd done was terrible and pleaded for clemency on the basis that he was sorry. But he too was hanged, actually, after the Belsen trial. So there were quite a lot of these people still captured by the soldiers.
What kind of condition were the survivors in, the people who, not obviously the guards anymore, but the camp inmates, what kind of condition would they have been in by the time that they were liberated?
All very bad. That's the first thing that you can say. But again, it varied to some extent, depending on the camp and who the prisoners were. These are, of course, large generalizations. But on the whole, the political prisoners who were organized in camp underground movements and had established camp committees and so on were not in as bad shape as Jews and slave laborers who'd been force-marched from one camp to another. And so the image that we have of the really emaciated, brutally treated survivors relates really to the large numbers of Jews and Eastern European slave laborers who'd been marched westwards at the end of the war. Because as the Red Army approached the camps in Eastern Europe, the Nazis evacuated those camps. They called them evacuations. We now refer to them as death marches, on which huge numbers of people died. But the survivors then ended up in Belsen, in Dachau, in Buchenwald, and they were basically left to fend for themselves. So again, this image that we have of huge numbers of emaciated survivors crowded together stems from this end period of the war, when these tens of thousands of Jews were suddenly forced to march to places like Belsen, where there was no food, in the last week of the camp, no water. And so they were dying in huge numbers. The awful images that we have of the camps on the liberation show, for example, the living and the dead intermingled with one another, naked inmates with obviously who have lost any sense of shame about wandering around naked, people scrabbling around looking for something to eat and so on. So the condition they were in was unthinkable, really, in these camps. These people were dying, first and foremost, of starvation, but also most of them had typhus, tuberculosis, and other diseases. I think most people now have seen those photographs and the films, and it's quite clear that the vast majority of survivors were in a terrible, terrible condition, which is why so many of them died after the liberation.
Yes, I was going to say, how much of a challenge was it for the Allies to then keep these people alive, because they were obviously in such a desperate state when they encountered them?
An enormous one. In the case of Belsen, which is best known to British readers, I think it was clear that the army was unprepared what they were going to find there, which I don't think was the army's fault. But when the camp was surrendered to the British, they were told by the Germans who surrendered the camp that they would find a small camp with a few thousand people, but that typhus was there. When they actually liberated the camp, they found, apart from 10,000 unburied corpses, about 60,000 people, probably 40,000 of whom were close to dying in Belsen. So the camp itself rapidly became the largest hospital in Europe. But in the immediate few days, the initial period of what we might call medical liberation or rehabilitation was thoroughly disproportionate to the task at hand. So there were clearly heroic actions taken by the liberating soldiers to reestablish the water supply, to find food, to divert medical care from the front line to the camp and so on. And very quickly, there were further medics and other helpers on the scene, a group of Quakers, groups of medical students, nurses, including German nurses from the local area who were rounded up to help. But even so, even within weeks and months after the liberation, inmates were still dying because it was effectively simply too late to save them.
And for those that did survive, how did they respond to the people who liberated them? How did they feel towards them?
Again, it varies. I mean, I think in retrospect, all of them feel enormous gratitude to the liberators. But at the point at which they were liberated, very many of them were too ill to understand what was happening. And that's something that sometimes gets forgotten. I have some quotations in the book from the point of view of both liberators and liberated that show that the liberating soldiers could see that the inmates often didn't really understand what was happening. Even 3 weeks after the liberation of Belsen, one of the medics says that he went into the huts where the inmates were still being housed to tell them that VE Day had happened and that there was no response. They didn't really understand what that meant for them. And the same is true from the liberator's point of view. In retrospect, many of them say, well, I was in a coma, or I was too dazed, I could hardly move, I didn't really understand. And sometimes they say it was only after we received some food, it was only after somebody treated us kindly or moved us from one place to another, which itself was a frightening experience because these inmates associated any kind of authority and being moved somewhere with potentially their deaths. So it took a while for them to realize, I think, that these people were actually there to help them. That's not universally true, of course. There are also stories of people who were well enough when the liberators arrived to understand. And so there are also very many moving stories of survivors running to greet their liberators, kissing them and hugging them and so on and so forth. But I think the majority of inmates took a while really to understand what was happening.
And did the treatment of the people who were liberated vary much between those who were liberated by the Red Army and those who were liberated by the Western Allies?
No, I don't think it did, actually. The crucial difference really is that the Red Army had fewer survivors to deal with because most of the camps that they liberated had already been evacuated, with some exceptions. So Theresienstadt, for example, at the very end of the war, there were quite large numbers of people still there. But actually, the Soviets did the same thing as the Western Allies, which was to establish medical care, hospitals, to use local doctors and often survivor inmates who had medical training in Poland, for example, in Auschwitz or Majdanek, to assist the survivors. But what they also did do was to wind up those programs much more quickly, I think, than the Western Allies did, and to try and get the survivors back home as quickly as they could. So the medical care runs on much longer in the case of the Western Allies, but that's because more of the survivors, particularly the Jews, wanted to get to the Western zones because they felt that they no longer had homes in Eastern Europe. And by ending up in camps in the Western occupation zones of Germany, they felt they had a better chance to get somewhere they wanted to go.
That in itself is an interesting question because, like you say, a lot of these people, their homes would have been completely unrecognisable. Where did they want to go in general, and where did the Allies have any plan for where they should end up?
Yes, well, before the end of the war at Yalta and before that as well, the Western Allies and the Soviets had agreed that at the end of the war, citizens of each of those countries would be assisted to return home. That means that the citizens of the Soviet Union and countries that the Soviets were now claiming as part of the Soviet Union, so the Baltic states, Eastern Poland, which had been incorporated into Ukraine and Belarus and so on, were now supposed to return to the Soviet Union. Very large numbers did, but by summer of 1945, there were still about 1 million displaced persons or DPs who were considered to be unrepatriable. That's to say, they were either Soviet citizens who refused to return to the Soviet Union because they didn't want to return to their lands, which had now been taken over by the Soviets, or because they were collaborators, or perhaps both. And there were large numbers of Jews who had discovered that, for example, in Poland, they were the sole survivors of their families, often the sole survivors or one of only a few survivors of whole communities, and that their former homes had been taken over by local Gentiles and so on. So they had nowhere to go. So they ended up in the displaced persons camps in the Western occupation zones. Most of them wanted to go either to Palestine or to the US. The Jewish citizens of Western Europe who were freed in the camps basically went home very quickly at the end of the war to the Netherlands, to France and to Belgium. But the vast majority of the rest wanted to go to Palestine or the US. And that's why they ended up sitting there for so long, because unfortunately the places where they wanted to go were not available as options to them.
What was the plan of, say, Britain and the other Western allies as to if there wasn't an option for them to necessarily migrate to either Palestine or America, what did they envisage them doing?
Well, this I don't think they envisaged anything very clearly. They wanted to find a solution whereby they could gradually emigrate. So the British did allow a small number of Jews, according to the quota, to emigrate to Palestine in a way that was supposed to be controlled and not to fuel Jewish-Arab conflict in Palestine. The Americans did also allow small numbers into the U.S., but basically they were housing the Jews in DP camps with the hope that they would could persuade other countries to take them in, which they did to some extent. Australia took in about something like 17,000 Jews in the year or two after the war. Canada took some, the Latin American countries and elsewhere. And the Jews in the DP camps, if they'd wanted to go, let's say, to Western Europe, they might have been able to do so. But the majority of them simply held out for what they wanted. Which is why, actually, I think this is often forgotten. Many of the DP camps lasted for much longer than we imagined, to the late 1940s and in one or two cases into the 1950s.
So was it with the creation of the State of Israel that the sort of populations of the camps would have reduced a lot, because then they could all go to Israel if they wanted to?
Yes. After 1948, the vast majority of the Jewish DPs then went to Israel. And after 1950, after the US amended the DP Act, then about the same number were able to go to the US. And they went in stages and in different routes, of course. So some who emigrated to Palestine or then to Israel did that as a stepping stone to getting to America, which they then later did. Some went to Israel and then returned to Germany because they didn't like it in Israel. Not very many, but it's an interesting phenomenon. And some, of course, then went to Britain or to other countries. But of the, let's say, 250,000 or so DPs in the summer of 1945, probably about half went to Israel and half to America, and some tens of thousands to other countries.
Why do you feel it was that they all were so passionately wanted to go either to Palestine or then Israel or America, as opposed to other Western countries, say?
I think for the surviving Jews of the Holocaust, the feeling was very widespread amongst them that Europe was simply no longer a place where Jews could live. That was it, quite simple. And that for many who'd lost their families and their homes and so on, Zionism offered a kind of substitute family, if you like. So particularly for young survivors, and most of the survivors were young, for fairly obvious reasons, I suppose, many of them joined incipient kibbutzim that were being formed, so the collective farms that were being established. So there were kibbutzim established in Buchenwald, in various other camps. Jewish survivors took over local farms or were allocated land by the Allies where they could set up these kibbutzim, which were kind of pioneer training centers for life in Israel. So often these places offered a kind of substitute family for people who'd lost their families. And there's an argument amongst historians as to whether the Zionism in the DP camps was generated, if you like, cynically by the Palestinian Jewish leadership, the Yishuv. That's to say, they exploited the surviving Jews to say, we're the only people who can help you, or whether it emerged in a sort of organic way amongst the survivors, out of a sense that it was their only real option. And I think you can see both, of course, in the way in which the survivors, who had a sense of their own agency, acted, but they also were, of course, being influenced by agents coming from Palestine to try and encourage them to move. And the same is true with America. America, of course, had already a large Jewish population. Many survivors had relatives who might have emigrated at the turn of the 20th century or before the war. And so America was a place that was A, not Europe, and B, where they already had some kind of connections.
Some of these people, you say, stayed in these camps for a number of years. Did that lead to any tensions between the liberators and the liberated?
It did. This is one of the sadder aspects of the story, particularly with respect to the British. The Americans played it more cleverly, in a sense, in that the Americans were more open to accepting Jews as DPs, even if they didn't meet, strictly speaking, the criterion for being a DP. So Jews returning from Eastern Europe, say, who hadn't been in Germany at the end of the war, or Jews who'd been in exile in the Soviet Union during the war, who then found that they couldn't return to their homes in Poland, they often moved to the American zone where they knew they'd be better treated. Whereas the British tried to enforce a stricter definition of who was a DP. But over time, this also meant that the Americans also took the line that the British, as had been recommended by various reports, the Harrison report and so on, should allow more of the DPs into Palestine. This was also somewhat cynical. It was used as a ploy to say the Jews should go to Palestine, not to the United States. But it meant that the British, who had liberated the Jews in Belsen and more widely in the British zone, then started to fall out with the committees that were the political committees that were being formed in the British occupation zone. So Josef Rosenzaft, for example, who became de facto the spokesperson for the liberated Jews in the British zone, although he writes very movingly in various places about how grateful he was to the British liberators, what great care they took in terms of medical care, he nevertheless became highly critical of the British stance vis-a-vis allowing Jews into Palestine. And so you have a situation whereby the people who liberated the camps then start to become rather bitter towards the people that they'd liberated, and vice versa. And this leads to tension within the British Army itself. So there are tales, I've been told, for example, by one man who was a private in the British Army at Belsen, that he was removed from his post because it was suspected that as a Jew he was acting as a kind of middleman, spreading Zionist propaganda, which was not true. But nevertheless, I think that there are a few instances of this whereby within the army itself there was suspicion about Jewish members of the military, and it led to very bad relations often between the British military authorities and the committees, the political committees. And in Britain, in the context of the worsening situation in Palestine, there were anti-Jewish riots in Birmingham and Liverpool and elsewhere in the UK in 1947, which have been largely airbrushed from history. But they're also rather hard to understand. There's a strong anti-Jewish feeling in parts of Britain in 1947, accompanied with still a very strong sense of sympathy for concentration camp survivors. And the two things somehow coexist in a rather uneasy fashion.
Obviously, a lot of these people were young at the time and have lived many decades after, may still be alive now. What kind of long-term legacy did these events have on both the liberators and the liberated?
They never forget it. It's perfectly clear that many survivors have gone on to lead ostensibly normal lives. They had, for several years after the liberation, often to travel illegally, in quotation marks, across borders to get to DP camps and then to try and migrate to somewhere they wanted to go. They had to learn new languages, learn new skills, meet new people, start new families. But many of them, I think, eventually settled into what we might consider something normal. Nevertheless, I use this as a quotation in the book, it's quite clear that there's a sense in which what happened to them never leaves. The notion of Holocaust trauma is quite well understood amongst scholars, the idea that people, whether they want to actively forget or not, cannot. And many survivors remained and remain traumatized by what's happened to them. I've got a quotation from one man called Ernst Israel Bornstein at the end of my introduction, who writes, While a former inmate of a concentration camp may laugh and be merry with others, he aches and bleeds inside because the old wounds will not heal. Even though he has left the spatially limited concentration camp, the terrible atmosphere of the camp still encompasses him. It is as though the Katzet was still inside him. So you see that this idea that the camp is something that you never quite escape is, I think, quite common amongst the survivors. And for the soldiers, the same is exactly true. There's a lot of very moving testimonies given by soldiers, American, British, Russian, from the 1980s up to the present, where they also talk about the fact that they can never get these images out of their mind. They can't forget, and it remains deeply imprinted on their minds. And they often, even 6-7 decades after the events, still start to cry when talking about these things. So I think it's clear that this is a defining moment for all involved.
And in the years that followed the liberation, how easy was it for people to talk about these events, and how keen also were people to listen to what they had to say?
That's quite an interesting question, because it was assumed for quite a long time that nobody really spoke about these events in the immediate aftermath of the war. But in fact, there were, I think that within certain circles, people did. So I've got some discussion in the book of, for example, survivor historians. So there were many historical commissions set up across Europe at this point, in Paris, in Warsaw, in Budapest, in Munich, elsewhere, where survivors started to interview other survivors and using questionnaires and so on to try and build an early set of testimonies from which a historical account could be written. Secondly, there were a few early attempts at what we would now recognize as collecting oral testimony. So there was a man called David Boda, originally from the Baltic states, but who was an American citizen by now, who went back to the DP camps in France and Italy in 1946 to interview survivors. And he used an early kind of recorder, a wire recorder, to record these interviews. And he then published a selection of them. So that was in 1946, when these events were very fresh still in people's minds. So there were certain circles in which people talked about this. In general, in society, I think it's perfectly clear at the end of the war that people knew about what we would now call the Holocaust, although that term wasn't current then, from the newsreels that people saw before seeing films at the cinema, from the newspapers, from information about the Nuremberg trials and so on. This information about the persecution of the Jews and the persecution of other population groups under Nazi occupation was quite well known, although it wasn't systematized, if you like. It hadn't been yet turned into something that scholars were working on in quite the same way as is the case now. So it was clear, I think, that there was no sense of what we might call today Holocaust consciousness. Survivors wouldn't necessarily get a sympathetic hearing in public, where nations, particularly in the immediate aftermath of the war, many of the Western European nations were engaged in a process of rebuilding. And that meant, by necessity, not talking about collaboration, different sorts of deportees, racial deportees, forced laborers, volunteers, and so on. They were all kind of merged into one. So although the fact that the Nazis had committed genocide was well known, nevertheless, it was a kind of undifferentiated sense of criminality. So Jews, for example, spoke about what they'd experienced within their own circles, not necessarily within a wider social milieu.
And when did that start to change? And when did people start to feel more open about talking about it?
I think in the 1960s, you see, first of all, the Eichmann trial, the Frankfurt-Auschwitz trials. You see the start of serious scholarly literature on the subject. So Hilberg's book, The Destruction of the European Jews, is published in 1961. And you also see, I think, most importantly, you see the beginning of the breaking down in the 1960s of many of the wartime myths. So the idea that, for example, that all the French had been members of the resistance, or that all Italians were good anti-fascists. This narrative, which had been, I think, promoted in order to create some kind of social cohesion after the war, was being questioned now by filmmakers and by scholars and by artists. And it started to allow for a greater sense of differentiation between different victims. And so I think it's at this point you begin to see, certainly the term Holocaust begins to be used to refer to the genocide of the Jews. And you have a stronger sense of the different experiences of different population groups under Nazi-occupied Europe.
That was Dan Stone. The Liberation of the Camps, The End of the Holocaust and Its Aftermath is out now in the UK, published by Yale University Press.
In the US, it is due to be released in late May, also by Yale. Now, just before we go, I thought I'd read out a message that we received from a listener to the podcast at historyextra.com address. Xavier Pierre, who listens in France, wrote in to say, "I'm sending you this email to express my gratitude. I'm a French history and geography teacher, and have listened to your podcast every week for years. Thanks to this, I've now been able to achieve a certification which allows me to teach history and geography to secondary school pupils in English. Thanks for that message, Xavier, and I'm glad we've been able to help you in this way." Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but do join us next time when we'll be talking about the Second World War as we reach the 70th anniversary of VE Day. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.